Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has slammed Kiev's destructive policies and growing Western arms supplies to Ukraine. Reference to Poland and the UK in this case, who have said that they will provide main battle tanks. Now, Russia has said that this means that they want the conflict in Ukraine to spiral even further, adding that those tanks can burn, and they will burn like the rest of the weapons. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this war will end on the battlefield or at the diplomatic table, something which the U.S. cannot come to grips with yet. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Moscow. Also joining us is Harley Schlanger, a spokesman for the LaRouche organization, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Fred, we all start with you. The latest is Britain's decision to provide Ukraine with these tanks by the name of 14 Challenger. Two tanks is the name to help counter Russia, as it, Downing Street has said, in the coming weeks. And the curious part about this, which I want to ask you, is that it's the first time that, as this was reported, a Western country has provided Ukraine with tanks. Why hasn't Ukraine received tanks before from a Western country?
Ukraine started the war with a lot of tanks. This is a sign, I guess, that they're pretty much drawn down their original arsenal. In fact, they've been resupplied several times. It's, I guess, also a sign that the Western countries are running out of ways to help Ukraine. I think that there've been several waves of, you know, weaponry, you know, starting at the beginning. You remember the Javelin missiles and all the hype about that. Then there were these HIMARS. And now it's about tanks and fighting vehicles. I think when the Russians say it won't make any difference on the battlefield, they're right in the big sense. It won't change the tide of war any more than the previous weapons did, but it will prolong the war. It will give the Ukrainians, because they have plenty of manpower, another impetus, another set of armaments with which to launch new offensives.
All right, a couple points there, Harley Schlanger, that I want to ask you. First of all, what Fred Weir said is really important in order to grasp this. And that is why, in waves, there are these announcements that are made about weaponry. I mean, it's pretty much been going on for quite some time. My question would be, first, why don't they just come out and give them all? What's the problem there? Now, secondly, the fact that this won't change the tide of war based on the most recent deployment that Britain has said, and that is about these tanks.
Well, there are two points here that are important. First,
NATO's goal is a permanent war until it weakens Russia to the point where NATO can do whatever it wants. The problem that NATO and the West has, the transatlantic, the U.S., the Anglo-American side, their problem is that they're trying to stop the development of a new financial system, a new strategic orientation away from Europe. And this is already occurring with Russia, with China, countries like India, the BRICS countries. They're moving in a different direction.
And so can you repeat that one more time? I'm trying to understand what you just said, so if you don't mind repeating it one more time, I'm sorry.
Sure. Why is NATO committed to a permanent war against Russia? Because Russia refuses to accept the idea of a Western rules-based order, which is not based on rules, it's not based on international law, it's based on the supremacy of the financial empire out of London and Wall Street. And unfortunately, European countries submit to that. And so that's why they're providing waves of weapons. They thought the sanctions would destroy Russia. The sanctions didn't. They thought that they could turn the world against Russia and isolate Russia. They didn't. In fact, Russia is less isolated today than ever with alliances such as the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and others. So the idea that more weapons will weaken Russia is the only thing they have. And the problem they have is that it's not going to win a war, but they're committed to permanent warfare. And that's something that people in the West don't understand. They believe the lie that Russia is losing, that Ukraine will win, and if we just provide a little bit more weapons, that will turn the tide. One final point on this. The United Kingdom is going through a horrible economic crisis. And the question has to be raised, how can Sunak justify sending more weapons when the British economy is on its back? There are strike waves, the population is angry. So I think the West has a losing hand, but they're going to continue the war as long as they can.
I'm curious as to why you picked the UK and not Germany.
Well, Germany is also facing a problem, but Germany still has more production and more riches than the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is quite weak economically, except for the city of London. But the problem is paper money and computer notations don't win a war. And NATO is trying to force Germany to provide more weapons, and there's resistance in Germany.
Okay. Taking a look at the notion of what our guest there, Harley Schlanger, said, Fred Weir, the whole notion of where this war is going to define which side has won or not, that's a big question mark. And who's to judge how that's going to happen? But at some point, that is bound to happen, especially given the way that we're seeing some of the important developments unfold, such as the batch of, again, military, not only military weaponry, but also the fact that we are getting reports, as I'm sure you're well aware, that both NATO and the U.S. and some of these European countries are running out of ammunition. They're running out of weaponry. So where is that going to, when is that going to reach, what time frame, and what is the definition of who has lost or who has won?
That's a huge question, and I can't answer it. I think there's a lot more to be, sad to say, to be played out on the battlefield. I think that what's going on in Donbass, whatever offensives are coming up before spring or by spring, may give us a much clearer idea of how the war can end. But however it does end, there's no doubt that the world system, globalization that we experienced over the past 30 years or so, and for some of us, for a lot of people in the global south, but for people like me, that was a really great time. If you had money, if you were prosperous, you could travel, you could enjoy cheap consumer goods. There was just almost no limit to what, you know, to the possibilities in that economic system, and that is fracturing now. We're going to end up with a divided world with probably countries like Russia, Iran, China, on one side, not just politically or geopolitically, but also economically, and the West on in another realm, not perhaps quite like it was in the old Cold War, not an ideologically divided world, or so strictly divided, but still not a functioning global system. And that will be the outcome of this war, no matter who supposedly wins it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we seem to be going on to this economically driven point that is being made, especially when rules-based order, as you mentioned there, Harley Schlanger, is what Russia seems to be fighting. But isn't Russia leading the way towards a system that did not have positive results? Way back, not even that far back, from 2008 up to now, and we're seeing what the world is in terms of the economic doldrums that it's in. Of course, taking away COVID, and I'm just saying what my knowledge is on this, and that's the printing of money that somewhat has led the world into the situation that it's in. Briefly, though, talk to us and tell us what this rules-based order is that Russia is fighting, that the West, led by the U.S., feels that it has to go to war and for lives need to be lost in order to preserve it.
Well, it's not just Russia that's fighting it. As Fred mentioned, the global South is refusing to support the efforts to destroy and isolate Russia because they know what colonialism is all about. They've been fighting it. This is the old non-aligned movement, which is reemerging. Now, on the economy, look, the United States on Friday will hit its debt ceiling, which means it's been bailing out bankrupt corporations to the extent that they can keep printing money. But if they keep doing it, the inflation goes off the charts again. So the West has a limitation as to what it can do right now with the post-industrial order. What it intends to do, and what I mean by the rules-based order, is the control by international banks, Washington, Wall Street, and the City of London and Brussels. These are banks and institutions that have been looting the global South for years. And they're the ones that insist that no nation has a right to sovereignty. They have to abide by the rules of the bankers. Now, the Russians are committed to sovereignty. The Chinese are committed to sovereignty. So are the Indians, the Egyptians, the Brazilians. And so there's a natural orientation away from that. Now, the war is designed by the West to convince the rest of the world that you shouldn't work with Russia because Russia can be beaten. But I think what we're seeing is the loss of support for the West because of its commitment to policies that so many countries have experienced in the past and are looking to escape. So we are in the question of who is lost and who has won. And in a sense, the military side is clear. Eventually, Russia will succeed, but at what cost? The more important question is, will a new monetary system come into existence? And just one other point here. I don't think Europe is going to stick with London and Wall Street, because I'm seeing very clear signs from France, from Germany, from Switzerland, from Italy, of a move away. They need Russia and China for resources and for markets. And I think that's why the change is inevitably against the unipolar order. The problem is they have a lot of weaponry to try and keep it in place.
So when we talk about the West Fred Weir, if you agree with our guests there from Germany, what's there left of the West, the U.S. and... Fred Weir, hold on to your thought. We're unfortunately getting cut off intermittently. So let me ask you that question then, Harley Schlanger. When we talk about the West, based on what you just said, who would be left? You have the U.S. and who else?
Well, it's the U.S. and the United Kingdom and Brussels. Now, if you look at Germany, Germany is having to tolerate something that's intolerable. The pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, was blown up. That was a Russian-German cooperation. The Germans are in Germany now, we're dependent on solar power and wind power. They're trying to scrounge gas and oil from around the world, and we're not getting enough of it. A cold wave is about to hit, and we're going to see some real problems hitting the economy in Germany and also in France. So I think that the attempt to keep this alliance together by placing demands for more weapons, gearing up of its industrial production, the West can't produce the weapons that are needed by Ukraine, or at least that are demanded by Ukraine. And Ukraine is running out of Soviet-era weapons, and NATO is depleting its stocks. Even in the United States, without an industrial, a real investment in armaments, and of course, $112 billion, that's a pretty big investment. But they're not going to have enough capability to continue this war. So I really think that we're going to see a shift.
Yeah, let's expand on that, because we need to, Fred Weir, if we have you, on this supply side of the topic here. Based on just one example, and this would be the production lever for artillery rounds for the howitzer. It's said that a long-range heavy artillery weapons that are currently used on the battlefields of Ukraine is about 30,000 rounds per year during peacetime. But with the Ukrainian soldiers fighting Russian forces, they go through that amount in roughly 2 weeks. There's no way that they can actually keep up with the production for that particular item. Now, you can go down the list here. So how can they even sustain, first of all, fighting Russia? And B, if this is the case, doesn't this mean that they have to make a decision? Unless the decision, which apparently is to continue, so they could ramp up production to meet the, I guess, the demands of the battlefield for Ukraine.
It will take some time, even if they do decide to go on a war footing. I think it was a U.S. Navy secretary who said the other day, I guess he was speaking out of turn, that within 6 months, the United States Navy will have to make a decision whether we're going to arm Ukraine or arm the United States Navy. They are up against it in terms of production, and it would require massive investments to go onto a war footing, as, for instance, the United States did do in World War II, very fast, and which Russia is now doing. It's not well reported, but the Russian economy is now in full mobilization mode, and all defense and defense-related industries are running three shifts a day, 7 days a week. The Russian side is ramped up to a full war footing, or will be pretty soon. They're also mobilizing. The math is in Russia is pretty solid for an effective war effort. In terms of Ukraine, which now is entirely supplied, it's completely dependent on Western imports for all of its military needs. Now, it doesn't have any of the Soviet-era weapons left. You know, the 152-millimeter artillery that was Soviet standard is all gone, and they're now using 155-millimeter NATO standard, which means that all the shells, not just the artillery pieces, but everything that keeps them running, has to be imported every day. It is a massive strain on Western industry, which is not going on. I mean, it's simply they're digging into reserves, stockpiles, and so on, but they are not going putting their industry on a full war footing, which they would have to do if this war is going to go on, you know, for more than a few more months.
If I could make a point there.
Yes, please, go ahead.
The U.S. and the British are also short of skilled labor. that even if they wish to have a mobilization, this is one of the discussions going on in the Pentagon right now, that they have a labor shortage and they have people who don't want to go to work in the defense sector. The other problem Ukraine has is they not only need all their weapons imported, they need funds to run the government. They're being totally subsidized by the European Union and the United States. So the real question then is, why not negotiate? Why is the U.S. so insistent that there be no negotiation? And that gets to the point I was making. The concern for the U.S. is to maintain the old rules-based order, the imperial system. And there's no way they can do that short of maybe a provocation to nuclear war. And that's the danger. That's why negotiations have to take place. That's why my organization is fighting like crazy to bring the NATO countries and the United States population to say to the government, no more war. We can't afford it.
Well, when you talk about the case of the UK that you mentioned, and also we should talk about Germany and other European countries for that matter, Fred Weir, let's take the UK as an example. I mean, how much clearer can the writing be on the wall when you have the year 2023 starting out with a bang, with strikes from different sectors that came through from last year? I mean, also this year, this week, we noticed the humongous crowds that showed up in Portugal. We're talking about also crowds in different European countries. I think that's pretty evident. And yet you're having Germany that had, what, 100 billion euros? That's a special fund for Ukraine, the U.S. Well, gosh, I lost count there. But, you know, we're looking at about $70 billion there. And then the U.K., $1.5 billion, the U.K. so far for Ukraine. Is that accurate? I think it is. $304 million in new military aid was just announced by Rishi Sunak. How are you going to answer to the people?
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the resilience of these societies and these political systems. I live in Russia. I'm a journalist in Russia, and I have to deal every day with catastrophic assessments of how Russia is going down the tubes and is doomed. And I see around me a lot of resilience in the society, in the political system. And so I don't want to go with those alarmist assessments. But yes, there's intense strain, and it's of a systemic nature in Britain, but also in Germany, which built its industrial prowess in the past 30 years on cheap Russian energy. You see a lot of German industries now looking to relocate to places where energy is cheaper because they simply cannot afford it. These are systemic alarm signals that are visible. I wouldn't overestimate them. I wouldn't look for collapse anytime soon, but it's definitely tectonic plates are shifting in the world today, and this war is a catalyst for them.
Was there a tectonic shift when you had the German defense minister resign, Harley Schlanger? What do you think that meant? What happened there?
Well, I think the German situation is moving in that direction. The latest polls show that only 42% of the population support the current government, and that's been dropping dramatically. Now, Lambrecht, the current defense minister, was dragging her heels on providing the Marder tanks and some of the other equipment that Ukraine was asking for. But the Social Democrats, who have to replace her, are having a hard time finding someone who will step in and do it. I think we're seeing at least the beginning signs of a revival of the peace movement in Germany. But on the other hand, one of the points Fred is making is the Germans have very little sense of national sovereignty right now. It's completely controlled by Brussels. And Brussels, just there was an announcement last week of, in a sense, a de facto merger between the European Union and NATO. At the same time, Japan was brought into an alliance with the United Kingdom as part of global NATO, and the Japanese Prime Minister is saying that Japan will help NATO in containing Russia and China. So they are trying to expand their operations, but what we've been discussing is there are limitations to that.
I'm curious what a merger on paper between the European Union and NATO would look like, but unfortunately we're just out of time here. Do apologize. Thank you, though. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for the LaRouche organization. Fred Weir, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator there from Moscow. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakway and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Now let's listen to 141st and 2nd verses of this chapter.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
كذبت ثمود المرسلين.
Thamud denied the messengers.
إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ صَالِحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ.
When their brother Salih said to them, will you not fear Allah?
كَذَّبَتْ ثَمُودُ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ صَالِحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. The Thamud people belied the messengers when their brother Salih told them, will you not fear Allah? This is the life story of Prophet Salih, the 8th section of this chapter, that the Holy Quran mentions the story of Prophet Salih, that he preaches righteousness to the people of Thamud, and the rest of the story. After the Holy Quran explained the story of Prophet Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Hud, it is time for us to have a look at the verses which the story of Prophet Salih is being discussed. The 142nd verse, and كذبت ثمود المرسلين إذ قال لهم أخوهم صالح ألا تتقون. So the life stories of a few prophets have been told in this chapter, each of which begins with the word belied. كذبت. This is because in these stories, maybe the most important point is the subject of prophets being rejected by the ancient people. And as a result of that belying and denying their destruction. أهلكناهم or هلاكة has been mentioned for them. So this is one important point. All the stories start with the word كذب and they all end with هلاك.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So as you can see, dear listeners, in writing and speaking, we must observe one important rule. The most important point must come first. This is how the story of all the prophets started in this chapter. كذبت ثمود المرسلين. The Thamud people belied the messengers. Now, this is not how we normally try to discuss the different stories in our everyday lives, but this is the Holy Quran we're discussing. It mentions the most important point in the very beginning. كذبت, and at the end, it leads to their هلاك. This is because in these stories, the most important point is the prophets being rejected. So in these stories, there have been stated nothing about the number of their people, the names of their places, the date of the events, and other details. But what is important is mentioned, because what is a gazing stock is to show the manifestations of right and wrong, and to say the victory of divine truth and the defeat of wrong. However, the fifth part of the story of the prophets, which has been mentioned in this surah, is the story of Prophet Salih, the people of Thamud, which is told precisely and, of course, really briefly. These people used to live in a land which is located between Medina and Syria. This land was called Wadi al-Qura. And they had a probably comfortable life, but as the result of disobedience and their insubordination somehow, they were so destroyed that there is no sign from them today. This story begins from the people of Ad and the people of Noah, and it shows how the events of history repeat. The verse says, the Thamud people belied the messengers. كذبت ثمود المرسلين. The divine prophets preached all the same, and when the people of Thamud belied their prophet, Prophet Salih, indeed they belied all the divine messengers together. And after mentioning this short explanation, the Holy Quran talks in details. We will surely discuss later on in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The filter attached to a dialysis machine is not a weapon. It is not a detonator for a bomb or any device that would be deemed dangerous. It is used to cleanse the blood of patients suffering from chronic kidney disease. So why is this life-saving equipment being blocked from entering Yemen? We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khalid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at Athoda Hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we opened this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the kidney disease center at Athoda Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Okay.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's a bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The largest biogas plant in Iran is under construction in the city of Mashhad. Biogas is a type of renewable fuel produced after organic waste, such as food scraps and agricultural waste, is decomposed in an oxygen-free environment, producing gases such as methane, which can be converted into electricity. Mashhad biogas plant will generate more than 22,000 megawatts of electricity per year.
At first glance, garbage is all about the expenses associated with its collection, dumping and burying. By using cutting-edge technologies in biogas system, we can generate energy from waste. We will transfer the gases produced in our landfills to the biogas plant and burn them to generate electricity.
Biogas is a mixture of gases produced in landfills, primarily consisting of methane, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen sulfide. Since biogas technology will consume all these gases to produce energy, it will prevent the emission of large quantities of toxic gases like methane and CO2.
Methane is highly detrimental to the environment. Some experts say it is 200 times more contaminating than carbon dioxide, but the good news is it can be turned into electricity. So when we launch this plant next year, we'll breathe cleaner air with less methane emissions.
Every year, some 30 million visitors arrive in Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. This has made the bustling megacity the second in Iran after the capital Tehran to produce the most waste, with 2,000 tons of garbage generated every day. With biogas technology now available, more trash means more energy.
Each cubic meter of biogas with 60% methane content converts to 6.7 kilowatt hours energy. So the large amount of waste produced daily in Mashhad can be utilized efficiently to generate clean energy.
Mashhad already has a smaller biogas plant built on a landfill on the edge of the city. For now, authorities say biogas systems account for a small portion of electricity generated in the city. They're planning to turn biogas into one of the main energy sources with the aim of promoting the use of green fuels.
Now that biogas is seen as a viable source of energy that's both renewable and eco-friendly, Mashhad municipality says the emerging technology needs to dominate conventional methods of energy production. The city is now planning to build more biogas plants, which can both optimize waste management and produce clean energy. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said Syria is keen on maintaining continuous coordination with Iran, especially now amid rapid regional and international developments. He reiterated that Syria will not press ahead with talks with Turkey unless the goal was to end Turkish occupation in Syria and the support of terrorist organizations. Abdullahian said any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and the region, expressing Iran's trust in Syria's stances and decisions. The top Iranian diplomat held separate talks with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Maqdad, focusing on expanding economic and trade relations between both countries. In a joint press conference, Abdullahian touched upon Syrian-Iranian economic ties.
Our relations with Syria are at their best condition. We must exert our utmost efforts to boost economic ties to the level of our political ones. We agreed to prepare a long-term strategic cooperation document to be signed in the near future.
He indicated to Iran's role in preventing a planned Turkish military operation in northern Syria, welcoming diplomatic efforts for ending disputes between the two neighbors. Miqdad said the visit comes at a critical time amid challenges facing Syria.
The visit comes as we face challenges set by the U.S., the West, Israel, and their proxies. They don't want the Syrian people to heal. Our relations with Iran are strategic, and soon there will be steps taken that prove the depth of relations and both countries' belief in the necessity of enhancing them.
Miqdad said Syria will not forget the repeated Israeli aggressions, promising at the right time Syria will respond and inflict heavy losses on Israel in a way it will regret all its attacks. Amir Abdullahian's visit is part of a regional tour aimed at evaluating developments with Iran's allies. It's a reminder of the strong ties among member states of the resistance alliance, despite decades-long attempts to break them by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Flowers, gifts, and poems. In Iran, it is once again the time of the year to celebrate women, their progress, and their victories. Traditionally, 1 week is designated as Women's Week in Iran, which includes the birthday of Hazrat Fatimah, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, celebrated as Mother's Day.
The days of Women's Week have been named as follows. After Friday, which is of course Mother's Day, the day of women and their role in the family, Saturday is named Women and Virtue, Resisting Western Patriarchy, Sunday, Women and Self-Esteem, Leaders in Scientific Fields, Monday, Women, Creators of the Next Generation, Tuesday, Women, Buoyant, Resourceful and Wise, Wednesday, Women, Security and Social Justice, and Thursday, Women, Hopeful and Faithful.
But this year, Iranians are celebrating Women's Week, while under U.S. pressure, the Islamic Republic was removed from the United Nations Women's Commission, and as foreign-backed rioters have tried to exploit the concept of women and their freedom for their own political gains. So I asked the Vice President how women's status has changed over the past four decades.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women were given more opportunities to take on social roles. Women literacy has increased from 35% four decades ago to 95% today. More than 60% of university students and 30% of faculty members and professors are women. We have over 2,700 NGOs, mostly run by women.
An issue that was also raised by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a special meeting arranged to honor Women's Week. But most importantly, the leader pointed to the fact that solidarity is key, and the issue of hijab should not be exploited to divide women. Women who were present chanted slogans to show that they agree with the leader. And this is what's highlighted Women's Week this year.
The occasion this year is of more significance than ever before. It has become an opportunity to shed light on the fact that the recent foreign-backed riots and the exploitation of women to divide the country was a failed attempt by Iran's enemies. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UK's rogue royal, Prince Harry, has come under fire both at home and abroad, after admitting he killed 25 Afghans during his military service. In his highly controversial memoir, Spare, Harry claims he killed 25 people during his two tours of occupied Afghanistan, adding he didn't think of them as people, but instead as chess pieces that had been taken off the board. Harry served as an attack helicopter pilot between 2012 and 2013. The book alleges that all the targets were combatants. However, following furious protests from inside Afghanistan, many British establishment critics have condemned the revelation, believing that it creates a new and unnecessary security threat against his own family members. Amid the condemnation, British Muslims feel particularly outraged.
I don't think Harry should be silenced for what he said. In fact, I think he should be encouraged to go into more detail about the ideology and the training that's being pumped into British soldiers. It's not even the first time that he's likened killing humans with playing games. In 2013, he said it was a joy to use his controller during airstrikes. He said it was like playing a PlayStation or an Xbox.
Afghans are also furious, with many, including Taliban officials, issuing demands for Harry to be put on trial for war crimes.
The consensus in Afghanistan, and amongst probably Muslim opinion all around the world, is that he was involved in a war where hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghans were killed, a nation was destroyed, millions were displaced, and therefore he is a war criminal who should be accounted for his crimes. I run a British Muslim website, and we did an online poll the other day, and it had about 5,000 votes. It was a one-day poll, and 85% of our readers and viewers said that Prince Harry was a war criminal. And that's because Muslims, you know, we consider ourselves one body. And if one part of the body hurts, the whole of the body hurts.
Many British Muslims are left questioning how they now view a royal family with Muslim blood on its hands. Robert Carter, London.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest, and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanad Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The National Women's Day in Iran does not coincide with the international occasion. as it is designated on the birth anniversary of a highly revered woman in Islam, Lady Fatima. Also known as Zahra, Hazrat Fatima was the daughter of Prophet Muhammad and the wife of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam. Here, in the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam in the city of Mashhad, Muslims from Iran and other countries gathered to celebrate the festive occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims on the birthday anniversary of Hazrat Fatima. Lady Fatima is an example of piety, compassion, and generosity. The Prophet Muhammad regarded her as the best of women. He kissed her hand in public to show the high status of women at a time when female children were seen as a disgrace.
Still, after 14 centuries, Muslims speak highly of Hazrat Fatima. Muslim women view her as a role model.
Hazrat Fatima made great contributions to the promotion of Islamic teachings. Fatima is extolled and praised in the Book of Quran in a surah called Kawthar, which tells Prophet Muhammad that God has given you Fatima as a gift.
Iranians' love for the daughter of Prophet Muhammad goes beyond these celebrations. Many families name their daughters after her, and that's why Fatima and Zahra are the most common names among Iranian women, including this lady who has asked her fiancé to start their marriage on the birthday of Lady Fatima.
My name is Zahra. My parents named me after Lady Zahra, and I'm so grateful for that. She is an inspirational figure. That's why my husband and I decided to start our marriage on the auspicious occasion of her birthday.
Lady Fatima's name went down in history as an alpha female who continues to inspire Muslim women to date. Iranians here say they celebrate Women's Day on Hazrat Fatima's birthday to shed light on the inner beauty of women and their pivotal role in building a better family and better society. Mashhad.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Islamic identity, and that is the performance of Salah. The five daily prayers and the other prayers that are called Salah are an important aspect of the child's upbringing, and the parents are the foremost individuals responsible for educating and nurturing Salah into the lives of the children. Indeed, Salah can be nurtured through different ways, like verbal and practical methods, like verbal reminders and practical demonstrations. But on the other hand, when the process of nurturing and education takes place, alongside there should be another process that goes forward, and that is the process of evaluation and assessment. The parents and other educators who are responsible for training the children and educating them in Salah need to take the time and have processes in place to test and evaluate the state at which the children's prayer is at. And indeed, through this method, they shall be able to rectify the issues in their own teaching and education style and methods, and assist the children in filling in the gaps wherever possible. We find this to be a very important strategy from within the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet and the Imams themselves. As we find from the seerah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, that one day he prayed Salah loudly, and thereafter Salah, he turned to his companions and he asked them, "Did I miss out anything when I was reciting?" And the companions at that time were silent. And Rasulullah asked again, "Is Ubay ibn Ka'b amongst you?" Then he came forward. Ubay ibn Ka'b came forward, and they said, "Yes, indeed, he is." And Rasulullah asked him, as we know, Ubay ibn Ka'b is one of those individuals who was responsible for the recording of the Qur'an, or writing down and inscribing of the Qur'an. And thereafter, he was also one of those who helped in compilation of the Holy Qur'an. So this person came forward and said, he came forward and Rasulullah asked him, did I miss anything?